You are listening to Any Given Sunday, a part of the Dead End Podcast Network. Please subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, and all other podcasting services. Please make sure you check out Dead End Hip Hop, Dead End Sports, Dead End Gaming, Is the Mic Still On, Chris Platt's Strictly Hip Hop and Hoops Talk, and a host of other shows on our podcast network. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. This is Any Given Sunday for Sunday, July 28th, 2019. I'm your host, Manny Brown. What's up, everyone? My guest this week is the acclaimed Seattle Times columnist, former beat writer for the Seattle Mariners, Larry Stone. Larry has been covering the Seattle sports scene, specifically the Seattle Mariners, since 1996 and has been a sports writer for over 30 plus years. So he brings a lot of insight and knowledge to Edgar Martinez. And that's what we wanted to have him on this week's show because, the great Edgar Martinez, who I loved, one of the great right-handed hitters I've ever seen in my life, watching baseball, one of my favorite hitters ever. Just love the way Edgar hit, his approach at the plate. What better way to celebrate and commemorate Edgar's induction into the Hall of Fame than to get the guy who co-wrote his autobiography, Edgar, the autobiography, which is out now on all bookstores across the land, of course. Larry penned that book with him, and he's going to tell us about it and tell us about Edgar's career and a bunch of other things. Larry, welcome to Any Given Sunday. Thank you for being my guest.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know you just got back from a trip to Cooperstown. For those of us who have not been blessed enough to be there, just quickly kind of get into that first. Just your experience going there. Is this your first time or have you been there before? And what is that experience like for those of us who have not been there?
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have been there for four inductions. This was my fourth. I did Paul Molitor when he was the Mariners hitting coach and the year Ichiro set the hit record. And then when Dave Niehaus won the Frick Award, they sent me for that one. And then, of course, for Ken Griffey Jr. and now for Edgar. It's just a magical weekend. And this was even better because I took my son who had just turned 20. So it was a nice father son trip. Ryan Divish from our paper took his dad. So the four of us traveled together, Ryan and his dad and me and my son. And it's just it's the center of baseball for a weekend. 50,000 people in Cooperstown, you know, beautiful Sunday induction. Got to go to a party that the Mariners threw for Edgar on Saturday night, and all the Mariners royalty was there. Randy Johnson and Griffey, and Jay Buhner and Lou Piniella. Another one of the highlights is there's a reception for the Hall of Famers on Saturday early evening, and the media gets to go to that, and so all the Hall of Famers are there. So you could be in the plaque room and you could be looking at the plaque of Cal Ripken Jr. and then turn to your left and there's the real Cal Ripken Jr. just standing there. So it's fabulous. I'd recommend it for anybody, even if you're not media and don't get some of those extra perks. Just being there is fabulous.
Awesome. Awesome. Any fun stories you could share? Anything, any tidbits, anything you learned from the weekend there?
Well, the first day walking down Main Street, we got there on Thursday night and drove in on Friday, and just walking down Main Street, I saw I'd been there like 10 seconds and saw Denny McLain, the last 30 game winner in baseball, was at a booth signing autographs. And before I'd reached the end of the street, I'd seen David Justice, Raleigh Fingers, Pete Rose, Daryl Strawberry. That's just the way it is when you're on Main Street, Cooperstown induction weekend. You're liable to see any and every baseball player imaginable, from the stars to the not so stars. You know, Bill Madlock was there, Pete LeCocq, who had a very undistinguished career with the Cubs and Royals, and whose claim to fame is that he's the son of Peter Marshall, the old host of Hollywood Squares. He had for some reason he had a booth there. I don't know if anyone would pay to get his autograph, but there he was. So, just that aspect of it is pretty cool.
Awesome. 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 Well, before we get into Edgar specifically, I want to talk about you. I usually like to, when I bring on guests for the first time on the show, I like them to kind of introduce themselves briefly, just kind of give the audience a brief bio of themselves, their career, just so that you can become better accustomed to who Larry Stone is.
Sure. I I got into sports writing when I was at the University of California, Berkeley, just kind of by happenstance. There was an ad in the school paper that said sports writers wanted, and I thought that sounded like fun. So I showed up halfway through my freshman year, and the guy who had been covering baseball had come down with mono, so they had a desperate need for someone to cover baseball. So they sent me out to be the baseball beat writer right off the bat without, you know, ever having written a word. And, you know, I enjoyed it. They thought I did well enough to keep me on the staff as a sophomore. And I was a sports editor by my junior year, and decided that's what I wanted to do with my life, and got hired at the Yakima Herald Republic right after graduating. This was a long time ago because I'm old. I was hired in Yakima in September 1979. So that means that in a month, I will celebrate my 40th year as a professional sports writer. Awesome. Spent six years in Yakima, moved on to the Bellevue Journal American, which doesn't exist anymore, but they hired me to be the Mariners beat writer. So that got me a taste of covering Major League Baseball. And after a year, I moved on to back to the Bay Area, where I'd gone to college, and 3 years at the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, covering all the Bay Area sports. And then I kind of got my big break, which was being hired to be the traveling San Francisco Giants beat writer at the San Francisco Examiner. And did that for 6 years, traveling with the Giants, the Barry Bonds, Will Clark years. And then got hired. There was an opening at the Seattle Times to cover the Seahawks. And I was, my wife was from Wenatchee and was kind of eager to get back to the state of Washington. So I applied for and got that job and just covered the Seahawks for one season, the 96 season. And then they moved me over to baseball in 97. And then I did that for the next 20 or so years until I became the columnist in, I think 2014. So that's what I've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years.
Awesome. Awesome. Were you originally from the Bay Area? I know you went to college in the Bay Area. Were you originally from there? Were you from Washington State?
No, neither. I was born and grew up in Southern California, LA area. I was a huge Dodger fan growing up. My dad worked for NASA, so I moved to, of all places, Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh, wow.
he worked on the Apollo mission and worked at the, he got a job that took him to the Marshall Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. So I went to high school for sophomore and junior year in Huntsville and then moved back to California to graduate. So kind of was all amazing. Over.
How was it growing up with a dad that worked for NASA? But that was some pretty cool story.
That was cool. Yeah, he wasn't an astronaut, unfortunately. Right. But he was more in the kind of the business end of it, but it was still cool. That was when space travel was still fairly new and exciting, and I went to my high school was Grissom High School, named after Gus Grissom, one of the guys who died in the Apollo accident. So it was cool. It was an unusual job for your dad to have, and I enjoyed the perks of it.
Awesome, awesome. What was it like? You mentioned in your intro that you covered the Giants. It was Barry Bonds, Will Clark years. How was it like covering that team?
I enjoyed it a lot. The manager when I got there was Roger Craig, Hum Baby, everyone called him, and he was a great manager. He was a great manager to break in for a kid who was kind of learning the ropes of being a beat writer, because he was, endlessly patient and had a good sense of humor. And then he was replaced by Dusty Baker, another great guy to cover, who I got, I had a good close relationship with Dusty. And it was also a good team to cover in that there were so many distinct personalities.
Right.
If you could cover Barry Bonds and Will Clark, and Jeffrey Leonard and some of the guys on that team, you could pretty much cover anybody, because they were, they could be difficult and stubborn and jerks and all that stuff. And you just kind of learned how to deal with that sort of stuff, which was invaluable lesson for later on in my career. I probably never covered a team that was as tough, although the Seahawks were kind of reminiscent of that, with strong personalities, like, you know, of recent years, with like Marshawn and Sherman and Bennett and, you know, all those guys, kind of reminiscent of covering those Giants teams.
Wow.
So it was good. It was good. Good training ground.
Yeah, I bet. In your opinion, what's the hardest part about being a beat writer for any sport, really?
Probably the day-to-day grind of the whole thing. I think it's gotten a lot harder than when I started because of the internet and the round-the-clock nature of it. This sounds like it's hard to believe for guys who cover the team now, but there was no internet. So if you had a story at 1 o'clock, there was literally nothing you could do with it. So there was less of a sense of urgency, and you didn't have to monitor Twitter because we didn't know what Twitter was going to be in 20 years.
Right.
So it was more relaxing or less stressful, because you just wrote your one story and you went home. Nowadays, you're virtually around the clock if you're a beat writer, from the which is why I'm glad I'm not doing it anymore. You know, you wake up, you got to check Twitter, you got to check the internet to see what everybody else had. When something breaks, you've got to immediately get on it,
right,
write your story, check on everybody else, and you don't really rest easily all day. You know, you go out to dinner with a beat writer and they're checking their phone constantly to see what's on Twitter. It's really, in a lot of ways, it's not very healthy. I think that now is the hardest part about it. It's the kind of the around the clock 24 hour urgency that exists. And I think it's burning out a lot of journalists, unfortunately.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. And just in that constant grind of having to kind of keep up with the Joneses, if one guy breaks a story, you know, you almost have to feel like, you know, you feel like you almost have to top that and let me get the scoop here on this. And, you know, just I can imagine it being just very, very competitive and unhealthy in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, it was competitive in the olden days, too, in a different way. If you had a scoop, it was more powerful in a lot of ways, because it would be in the morning paper, and your competitor would have to live with it all day long.
Yeah.
And you know, there was an anxiety of, you know, I remember getting up at 4 a.m. to run out to the driveway to see what, you know, whether I'd gotten beat on a story and what the other paper had. So you had that anxiety too, but it wasn't, you know, nowadays, if somebody beats you on a story, you can rectify that and do your own work and get it up on the website right away. Then you had to wear it 24 hours before you could come back with something else. But I think it's leading to, this is a generalization, but, and I'm not the first to make this observation, but it's leading to shoddier journalism, because you're so cognizant of getting it out there on the web or on Twitter that you sometimes, guys and women, will put it out there before they've fully vetted it, just because they want to be first. And you didn't have that pre-internet and pre-Twitter and all that. You could take a little more care in getting the story right and developing the story and getting it fuller and richer than now, when you just throw it out there when you first have a, you know, an inkling of something.
Right. And I also think the audience is also at fault for that, too. When you mentioned the shoddy journalism and the kind of the thirst to be the first to scoop something, you know, I mean, you know, if you're almost not the first to scoop something, you're almost getting killed by half of Twitter. You know, well, why didn't you have this? Yeah. Or if you scoop something that you didn't get right, or, you know, something changed within 15 minutes in the constant news cycle, you know, people are ripping you to shreds about why you didn't get this right and all that. So I think the fan base, you know, we've gotten accustomed, and I blame myself too. I'm a fan. So, you know, I think we've kind of put that pressure ourselves on these reporters and these beat writers to, you know, be the first to these stories.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You do hear. I mean, you've got to recognize that what the 10 people who are making a lot of noise on Twitter don't. And right. This is really hard to do. Do not represent the majority. Absolutely. You know, there's a tendency to think that, oh man, everybody thinks that the manager should be fired when there's, you know, it's five people. And with Scoops, nobody even remembers, you know, it's nice nowadays. It's nice to be the first with something, but then everyone just moves on to the next thing. And 48 yeah. hours later, no one even remembers who had that last story first. So, you know, I think it takes a lot of discipline and in a lot of ways, a lot of guts, but I think it's more important and you get more respect in the long term if you're known as a person who gets it right rather than one who, you know, occasionally gets it first, but right, other absolutely. Other times gets it first, but gets it a little bit wrong.
If you were a sports editor in today's climate of media, how would you counteract some of these issues? You know, what would you tell your young reporters, your young beat writers out there, your young columnists, everybody in general? You know, how would you kind of wrestle with that? And what kind of advice would you give them?
I would give them just what, you know, I was told and what I think continues to be the guiding principle is getting it right is better than getting it first. And I won't hold it against you. If, you know, you also want to break stories and stuff, but to me, you know, signing a guy's going to sign and it's going to be released and a press release in an hour. And one person has it in 10 minutes before everybody else or 5 minutes. You know what, in the big picture, that's not that big a deal. So I would try and maybe relieve some of that stress from my writers. And I would also try to somehow make it more of a sane job. And I'm not sure how possible this is. A lot of this, you have sort of self-inflicted pride and work ethic where you're, you know, you could tell you know, Bob Condotta at our paper who covers the Seahawks and Ryan Divish, you could tell him like take an evening off and be with your, you know, your family or whatever, but they're so driven that they're mm-hmm. still going to be monitoring. They're still going to be monitoring the internet. And I would just try and find a way to not make it so oppressive and all consuming, because I think that's the way to keep your writers fresh and not burned out, because I just see it time and time again from people who just they got to get out of the the cycle after, you know, a few years.
Yeah, I can imagine. What's the best part of being a beat writer? We've talked about the horror stories. What's the best part of doing that job?
Well, I liked the daily challenge of, you know, in baseball and also in football, you know, the games aren't that much different. You know, you come from behind and win, you blow a lead, you win big, mm-hmm. you lose big, you know, four basic outcomes. And yet your challenge is to find an interesting and fun and different way of expressing that day after day and doing it on under deadline. And I really always loved that challenge. And you also get to be on the inside. You know, a lot of people who love baseball or love football or love basketball would love to be on the inside and get the, you know, the off the record stuff and the inside story and get to meet the participants on a different level than you do when you are just a fan or an outsider. So, you know, I think that's, I think there's a lot to that as well.
Interesting. And from your own personal experience, what sport did you find the most challenging to cover? Was it the NFL team? Was it the Major League Baseball team? What was the most challenging team or sport to cover?
Well, probably in a way it was baseball, just because there's 162 of them.
And, right.
You know, you had so much access to the guys, which was a blessing and a curse. You know, the clubhouse is always open before every game and after every game and spring training. And, you know, it's a way to get to know and really develop a relationship with players, but it's also kind of to the point where they get sick of you, like you again,
right.
You know, that sort of thing. So that was a difficult part of it. And what was the question? It somehow it slipped my mind. Is it the most challenging part?
Which sport was the most challenging?
Now I remember what I was going to say. But I had a comfort level with baseball just because that's what I played in high school. And, you know, I played some football too, but after several years, I got comfortable with the rhythms of baseball. And then I, you know, covering the Seahawks, I had to kind of learn that. But there's a lot of basic principles of beat writing that really aren't different no matter what the sport is. So I really enjoyed the season I covered the Seahawks as the beat writer. With John Clayton was covering for Tacoma and Claire Farnsworth, longtime beat writer for the Seattle PI. So yeah, I really enjoyed the beat crew that was there that year, and it was Dennis Erickson was the coach, and he was a fun guy to cover. So I had a lot of fun with that. But when they offered me the chance, that was 2 years. 1 year after 95, miracle with the Mariners, and there was a lot of baseball interest, and they decided to expand their coverage. And they asked me if I wanted to be part of that, and I jumped at it. Otherwise, I would have been happy to still keep covering the Seahawks.
Awesome. Awesome. And transitioning over into being a columnist, what's the biggest difference between being a columnist and just being following a beat for a team or a sport?
Yeah. Well, I try to, one of my bosses, when I got the job, his piece of advice was keep reporting. Just because you're a columnist, the best columnists also do their own reporting. So I try to keep that in mind and try to report as much, but it's a different kind of pressure. And, you don't have that ultimate responsibility of the beat. You know, the buck stops when you're the beat writer, the buck stops with you. And that's a lot of pressure and stress. And yeah. you don't have that when you're the columnist. And I like the variety. Instead of just covering the team day in and day out, I can go do the Seahawks one day, the Huskies the next day, the Mariners, the Storm, the Sounders, or just something completely off the wall or off beat that doesn't have anything to do with any sport, but it's an interesting story. So I love that aspect of it. And, and sometimes you have to take a hard stand, and, that could have its own challenges, but that's what the job entails.
So talk to me about the creative process of, you sit down, let's say today you get an idea for a story, or your editor pitches you an idea for a story. Talk to me about the creative process that you take, like, okay, I'm going to cover it from this angle or from that angle, the actual reporting aspect of it that you embark on. Just talk to me about the entire creative process that you go through about writing a story and crafting that out.
Well, I like to familiarize myself, maybe overly so. I'm a researcher, and now it's a lot easier to do that with Google and LexisNexis and all that. So, so if I'm writing a story on, Bobby Wagner or something, his contract, I will Google and read, before I do anything, 20 stories on Wagner and his contract situation, just so I am familiar, overly familiar with it. And then I'll just think about it and, come up with a take, and then do whatever interviews I need to be done or phone calls to get background, or, go out to the Seahawks, and if he's available, talk to him or who you can talk to. And then I just, let all that sort of just like slosh around in my brain and sit down and write. And, I'm a fairly fast writer once I get in my head what I want to write. I think that comes from the 40 years of being under deadline. you just can't, you know, if you work for a newspaper, you either learn how to write fast and under deadline, or you find another profession, because the paper's got to be published and you've got to hit that deadline. So,
right.
I think a lot of people in other lines of work are kind of envious. And I know my wife is, when she has to write something for her work. It's like, how do you write it so quickly? And it's like that, cause I have to, maybe some quality is sacrificed by that mindset, but it's something that's just ingrained in me. So, when I know what I'm going to say and I sit down at the computer, it doesn't usually take too long.
Right. What's your favorite column? What's your favorite piece that you've ever written since you've been doing the job?
I've done some longer. They're almost like takeouts, but I did one on K2, the mountain in Pakistan, China.
Right.
The 40th anniversary of the first American team to conquer K2, and they were all almost all Seattleites. And so I really dug into that one, and I really liked the way that turned out. Some of the recent stuff on Edgar,
which was great work, by the way. Just had to tell you.
thank you. I mean, it was a topic that, you know, since I spent a year with him working on his book, was near and dear to my heart. So it wasn't necessarily a real stretch, but it was a challenge to, after having written the book, to come up with something different. So we put out a special section that ran the Sunday that he went in, and I wrote the lead story. And, you know, I was pleased with that, because even though I'd written so much, I felt I came up with a pretty good angle, and
nice.
And it turned out well. So, I'm sure there's other ones. I know there's other ones, but it's one of those questions that I'll think of about five more when I hang up. But.
No worries. Yeah, no worries. The challenge of being a columnist, do you ever run into the problem where you may write a story that may not be so hot on a particular issue or a particular player, for instance? You know, you brought up Bobby Wagner, for instance. Let's use him as an example. Mm-hmm. Not saying that you have written a bad story about him or anything, but just saying, let's say you had to write a story about him that is unpleasant or comes at it from a different angle. Talk to me about that challenge. Do you go to the person first and say, hey, I'm writing this, or I'm thinking of writing this, you know, just kind of give you a heads up? Or do you write it, then go to the person? How does Larry Stone attack that when you have a challenging issue or challenging anything?
Well, first of all, I try not to ever be personal. You see some columnists who just take shots. I'm just not that kind of, that's not my personality. So, I write things that, you know, if I attack somebody, it would be their performance or something. And, I probably wouldn't, I just wouldn't be mean spirited. But that doesn't mean that people don't get upset with what you write. You know, there's some around the Mariners, the ownership who haven't liked my stance on the team and the way it's run and that sort of thing. I've gotten phone calls at home from Bud Selig when he was the commissioner of baseball, who really didn't like some things I wrote about him. I wouldn't necessarily tell the person that I'm going to write it, but I would make sure that I show up the next day. That is, I think any columnist or really any writer would tell you that that's the key to the whole thing, is just show up. And if anybody, just so that if anyone has anything they want to say, they can't accuse you of hiding or, you know, hit and run or anything like that. Just be there. You know, even if it's a day off, I've gone to the ballpark on a day off just so I could stand there if somebody wanted to say something to me, and then gone home. And I know Matt Calkins, my comrade, patriot at the, as a columnist at the Seattle Times, feels the same way about that. And that's something that I definitely learned from other columnists along the way. And I've never had too bad a reaction. You know, Steve Kelly, who I replaced at the Seattle Times, he has some stories of people who have threatened to kill him and that sort of thing. I've never had that, which maybe that means I'm not being tough enough. I don't know. Or maybe I have a better bedside manner than Steve or what. I don't know why, but so yeah, I mean that's you do have to sometimes write unpleasant things about that, about people, and that sometimes isn't so fun.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine. Transitioning over a little bit into, but before we get into Edgar, I read a piece that you did on Jim Bowden, recently deceased author of Ball Four. Did a little interesting take on it from his, you know, his connections with the Seattle Pilots and basically the birth of Seattle baseball. Talk to me about Jim Bowden, and specifically for folks of my age, you know, that are growing up in a world where Ball Four just seems like it's not a big deal, you know, like it's like, oh, what's the big deal about a writer or a former player writing some, you know, stuff in a book? You know, we see that almost every day now, you know, to explain the impact of that book and Jim Bowden, that had its time, because I think a lot of people, even when his death happened, you know, recently, and I was doing some research on him. You know, I think a lot of people now just kind of like myself, just don't blink twice about it. Don't blink twice about the impact that book had and how coverage of athletes has changed since then. You know, just kind of go into that a little bit and how that has changed from when that book was released and the impact of that book.
Sure. Well, I was 12 when that book came out, so I was sort of like a part, you know, I was there in the middle of it, because up until that point, if you read a sports book, it was a gee whiz. These guys are heroes. Here's all the great things about baseball or football or whatever. And what this did was it showed you what it was really like. And it just hadn't been done. There had been some people that sort of dipped their toes in that water. You know, a guy named Jim Brosnan, a reliever with the Reds, had written a book called The Long Season, but it wasn't anywhere near as intimate as Ball Four was. You know, Jerry Kramer of the Packers had written a diary type book called Instant Replay, but that was pretty fawning over Vince Lombardi and that sort of thing. But this book had Mickey Mantle leading expeditions, you know, to in the dugout, drilling holes in the dugout so they can look up women's skirts. That's, you know, that sort of thing, where you know, Mickey Mantle, who was the sainted all-American hero, just in a different light. So I think it was so influential in that the sort of journalism that we had today, I think in a lot of ways sort of began with Jim Bowden, because athletes, writers sort of realized that you didn't have to only write these fawning stories. You could tell the truth and what really happened. And there were a ton of tell-all type books that led to, that followed from that. And to now, where, you know, there's certainly no soft peddling anything that happens with so many websites and Deadspin and all that right. sort of thing. You know, nothing is off base anymore, pretty much. And, you know, a lot of that sort of the beginning of that process and that realm of journalism, I think, was Ball Four. And it was revealing, but it was also funny. You know, I haven't read it in a while. It probably doesn't seem nearly as racy as it did when I was 12 years old, but no one even remembers most of the players in there. You know, who remembers Ray Oyler or Dooley Womack or any of those guys? Most of them wouldn't have been remembered for a second after they retired if it wasn't for Ball Four. And most of them are forgotten to anybody who hasn't read the book or who wasn't related to them now. But it's just a hilarious account of what it's like to be on a baseball team, and you just didn't get that anywhere else.
Did you ever interview or cover Jim Bouton?
Yeah, you know, when I came to Seattle, I did lots of stories on the Pilots. Every time there was an anniversary, you know, the Seattle Pilots were here in Seattle for 1 year. That was the team that Bouton was on that he chronicled in Ball Four, the 1969 Seattle Pilots. And so, you know, every time it was 25 years or 35 years within, or 45 years, and they just had 50 years, I would call up Bouton, and he loved to talk. His number was listed or was easily available, and you'd call him up and he'd talk as long as you wanted to about Ball Four, about the Pilots. So I probably interviewed him 10 times. He came to Seattle, when the Sabre Society of American Baseball Research, their national convention was in Seattle about 8 or 9 years ago, and he was the keynote speaker. So, you know, I'd listen to his speech and talk to him then. So, you know, I certainly didn't have a friendship or anything with him. I think he came to know my name and stuff, but, you know, that, I think that gave me a little more insight when he died last month, and I had to write kind of an appreciation of him. So I think it was right in my wheelhouse, I think, because Ball Four was so influential to me, because I had a little bit of a interaction with Bouton, and I think I understood his impact.
Yeah, definitely a huge impact, an underrated impact, honestly. I think a lot of people don't really appreciate the impact of that book and what it did and how it really changed the coverage of athletes going forward. Like you said, you know, some would say for the better or worse. I mean, depending on your perception of that. But yeah, definitely a huge impact on
this. Well, you know, it's funny you should say for the worse. I mean, he was vilified by his fellow athletes.
Yeah.
Who you know, in the immediate aftermath when he came back in 1970, and the book, he was at the end of his career anyway, so it didn't really matter to him. It made him famous and made him a lot of money in the long run. Then, but the commissioner called him in. I mean, it was a scandal. This book, you know, the fellow players thought he had violated the sanctity of the clubhouse. You know, the rule: what you see here, what you say here, it must stay here. You know, that's something that's in every clubhouse. It's either written explicitly or it's known implicitly, and he violated that in a lot of people's minds. And so a lot of people were furious at him, and without that, you know, it added to the publicity for the book too. And you know, now that when he died, there's been a revival of Ball Four. It's been, you know, people are giving it another look, which I think is a great thing. After you know, it was published 50 years ago, and it was published in 1970. So we're coming on the 50th anniversary, and here it is getting it's the, you know, number one selling sports book in a week after he died.
Yeah. And you also got banned from the Yankees, couldn't come back to Yankee Stadium for a long time, and, you know, didn't come back to 98 for an old timers game. I think that's what, and I do, just doing the research, his son wrote a letter to the Yankees, basically, you know, saying it would mean a lot to the, you know, to him to come back. I mean, it's just a glimpse into everything that the guy went through, you know, because I think people kind of take the celebrity aspect of it. Oh, he wrote this influential book, and, you know, he really made a lot of money off of it. But, you know, he kind of suffered a long time with the impacts of that book and everything that he went through.
Yeah, and there's a cool, kind of a cool story behind his return to the old timers game. When Mickey Mantle's son died, Bouton wrote him a letter saying, you know, expressing his condolences that his son had died, and saying that he hopes he still doesn't have hard feelings about Ball Four, that he didn't mean anything personal towards Mickey. And Mickey left a voicemail on Bouton saying he never had any hard feelings, or he's over whatever feelings he had, they're long gone. That he said, I'm not the reason that you're not coming back to Old Timers Day. I never said that. And that meant, I talked to Boughton about this, and that meant everything to him. And then Boughton's own daughter died in a car crash. And that's when his son wrote the letter to, it was an open letter in the New York Times to George Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, saying, you need to invite him back. It would mean so much to him at this point in his life. And the Yankees agreed and brought him back. And that was a huge thing for Boughton, kind of closure for ball four and the bad feelings and everything. And he was back in the Yankees' good graces after that.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome story. Amazing life. And I think people forget, too, he was actually a really good pitcher for a while with the Yankees. You know, he had 2 years. I think he won 39 games in total in 2 years. So, you know, he had a pretty decent career until arm troubles starting to affect him. So I think that's another thing I think people forget about. I didn't even know. You know, I just thought, you know, I knew he was a baseball player and I knew he was a pitcher for the Yankees, but I never knew the level of success that he had attained, you know, in a short period.
Yeah, I mean, he was a left-handed fireballer who he won 20 games, I think, his second year. And he pitched in the World – the Yankees were in the World Series in 63 and 64, his first 2 years, and he was in their rotation with Whitey Ford, you know, all those guys pitching in the World Series. And then, as you mentioned, he had arm problems, and then he became a knuckleballer. And by the time he was playing for the Pilots, he was just hanging on with a knuckleball and was just not very good at that point. And he ended up getting traded in the middle of that season to the Houston Astros, which is a funny part of ball four too, how his time with the Astros, if you read the book, I think you'd certainly enjoy that too, with Leo the legendary Leo DeRocher was by that point the manager of the Astros. And it was pretty humorous with some of the things that happened there.
Yeah. Rest in peace, Jim Boughton. Amazing life, amazing career. Let's move on to Edgar. And before we get to the book, just talk to me about covering Edgar for, you know, the majority of his career with the Mariners. Just talk to me about, because I think Edgar is a guy that I think on so many ways, he's so underrated and so forgotten about, you know, not in a negative way, like, you know, forgotten about, like people don't remember him. It's just that people don't think about Edgar because he didn't have the personality and the youthful exuberance of Ken Griffey or the personality of Jay Buhner or Alex Rodriguez. But Edgar was just a guy every day that was in the lineup, produced. Talk to me about Edgar, his career, your interactions with him before the book, before working with him on the book and everything. Just kind of talk to me about how Edgar Martinez was, the baseball player, just covering him each and every day.
Yeah. Well, you make a great point. He was never the focal point for Griffey joined the team in 89, and it was Griffey's team from that point on. And it was Randy Johnson's team. And then it was Alex Rodriguez's team. And then when Alex left, it became Ichiro's team in 2001. So there was always a brighter, flashier, more famous superstar out front. And he liked it that way. You know, he's just not a me guy. He's quiet. He's a little bit shy, in fact. Just wants to do his job. But if you ask anybody who played for the Mariners, and believe me, I asked everybody. I talked to just about everybody. And they will all tell you that he was the heart and soul of the team whenever he was on it. Well, no, it doesn't matter who was out front. He was the guy that everyone looked up to. They knew he was the master craftsman at the plate. He was the guy they went to if they had questions about a pitcher, his stuff, how they were pitching him, you know, why they were slumping, or Edgar would go to them. He was happy to help. And he was also much more fiery than you would think. He had a little bit of a temper. He had a burning will to win that they knew about on that team, even if it wasn't always apparent to the fans, because, you know, he rarely showed it. But when he did, kind of like, look out, still waters run deep, that kind of thing. So, I came to Seattle in 96, which is the year after his double. I wasn't here for that. And then I moved over to the Mariners in 97. So I covered him his last 8 or 9 years of his career. And, you know, really enjoyed covering him, developed a pretty good relationship with him. In 2001, when A-Rod signed with Texas, his first game with Texas was they were going to play the first game of the season. The Rangers opened in Puerto Rico against the Blue Jays. And so they decided to send me to that game because there was, you know, obviously there was still a lot left in A-Rod. Right. Newspapers had bigger budgets in those days, so they could do something like that. So I decided, like, well, I'm going to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Why don't I go and check out Edgar's hometown? So, and do a big story on that. So I did a long interview with Edgar about his upbringing and his hometown, and went to Dorado on that trip. Rented a car and drove. It wasn't not that far from San Juan, 40 minutes or so. And you know, you asked me my favorite column, but if you ask me my favorite story, it's probably that one. The story, a long, which we just actually ran in the paper last week as part of this package of Edgar stories. That was the first one, was this almost 20-year-old story I wrote on him growing up in El Dorado, or in Dorado rather. And I think that's probably the germ of the book, was seeing, hearing his remarkable story and meeting a lot of his relatives in Dorado, and just kind of tucked that away. And then after he retired, I still continued to have a relationship with him. You know, we'd do stories on every year when the Hall of Fame vote came up for 10 years. I talked to him then. He asked me to help him out with a project that he was working on, some batting tips and stuff. And he wanted some help writing it, so I helped him with that. So, I think I had built up a decent relationship with him to the point where he was comfortable doing the book with me.
Awesome. I'm sure you got to talk to him a lot during that 10-year period when he didn't get into the Hall. Did you ever notice, and I'm sure it's in the book, I haven't had a chance to read it, unfortunately, just yet, but I'm sure you talk about it in the book to a certain extent, but did it ever bother Edgar? I know he probably had a great poker face about it, but did you ever, even in your private discussions, did you ever just notice that it ate away at him, or that it bothered him a little bit that he had to wait so long to get into the Hall?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, he's very stoic about it. You know, it goes right in line with one of the narratives of his career, is that he had to wait so long to get into the major leagues,
right? Yeah.
And get a starting job. I mean, he, in 1987, 88, 89, he tore up the AAA PCL and, won batting titles, and yet he couldn't stick behind. He was behind Jim Presley and Darnell Coles. So it took him till 1990, when long after he should have been a major league regular, to finally get the job. And, he used to tell people it didn't bother him that, the team was doing what they had to do, and he would get the job when he wanted. But he finally, for the book, he admitted that, it did bother him. And, all those years later, 20 years later, he could admit that he was frustrated and impatient and all that. But I did not get that same sense with the Hall of Fame thing. He knew from the start that it was going to be a long haul, because he knew that he was a DH for most of his career, and that there was going to be some backlash against that. And he didn't have the 3,000 hits. He only had 2,247 hits. He didn't have the 500 homers. He only had 309 homers. He could have overcome the DH bias if he had had those benchmark numbers, but he didn't have those. So I do know that halfway through, 5 years through, he was at 25%, I believe it was, 25.2% with 5 years to go, and you need 75%. At that point, I think he pretty much gave up that he was going to get into the Hall of Fame. And, I did too, to be honest. I didn't see how he could recover from that hole, from that deficit, to get the 75%. And yet, it was like a miracle. He just, he moved up to 27% the next year, and then 43% and 58%. And it just, the momentum began to swing the other way. And I think the year he got 58%, 2017, that's when he began and everyone else began to realize that, hey, this really could actually happen. And that was with 2 years to go on the ballot. So I think he had to wrap his mind around many different ebbs and flows of this thing, where early on, right out of the gate, he got 36%, which wasn't bad for the first year. So I think he thought, oh, I might have a shot at this. And right. then it went the wrong direction. And like I said, he was down to 25%. And that's when he thought, you know, it ain't going to happen. And if it's going to happen, it's going to be the Veterans Committee, not the baseball writers. And then there was another turnaround. So I did not ever detect any bitterness or even frustration. Maybe with his wife and family, but not with me.
Right. Real quick before we get to the book, what's your stance on the whole DH thing? Because I've never quite understood that narrative that, you know, the Hall of Fame voters look down on DHs and guys that didn't play a position in the field. I just never understood that bias. Where do you stand on that? Because seems very antiquated and it's a terrible view. Because to me, you get judged on your numbers. And while he didn't have those benchmark numbers, he had a hell of a career. And anybody who watched him play knew the guy was just an amazing Hall of Fame hitter.
Yeah. Well, I voted for him every time he was on the ballot, 10 straight times. So that should answer your question. I think it's a position in baseball, and it's like a closer. How could you? Mariano Rivera was pitching one inning at a time, more or less.
Right.
So if you're going to downgrade a DH because he didn't play the field, then you have to downgrade a closer because he only pitched one inning at a time, and he was unanimous in his first time on the ballot, as well he should have been. I understand the argument that if he had had to play in the field, that maybe, you know, his numbers would have suffered. But I mean, that's the way baseball is. There's a DH, and his numbers were clearly, if you looked deeply enough and open-mindedly enough, you know, the 300, 400, 500, 300 batting average, 400 on base, 500 slugging, you know, that's so rare in baseball, and virtually everyone who's done it. Yeah, well, everyone who's done it is either a Hall of Famer or not a Hall of Famer because of they're not eligible or because of steroid accusations. So his numbers in so many ways are better than David Ortiz. David Ortiz has the 500 homers, right. But you know, WAR and all the esoteric stats really strongly favor A-Rod over Ortiz. And so I think there were just a lot of people who wrote a lot of articles and made it safe to vote for Edgar because they just, you know, Jay Jaffe comes to mind with Sports Illustrated, who was a strong advocate. And, you know, there was five or six or seven or 10 more who Jason Stark. And, you know, when people like that started advocating for him, I think it sort of freed up other people.
And other Hall of Famers, I mean, I remember Pedro saying that was the toughest hitter he ever faced. Pedro Martinez saying this. Randy Johnson came to his defense.
That's right. Ken Griffey Jr. in his speech, he put in a bid for him as well. So yeah, I think that helped. I think that helped for sure. And the Mariners did a good job of making his case. They sent out a packet, not every year, but the last few years, that put in one spot all his numbers and where he stood and compared, and testimonies that you mentioned from, you know, Pedro and Mariano and Randy and George Brett and, you know, Cal Ripken. It made for a powerful and persuasive case that I think helped him as well.
Definitely, definitely. And finally, with the book, talk to me about the process of sitting down and actually writing the book. Who came, obviously it was Edgar wanted to tell his story. But just tell the process of how that came to be, how you got involved. I know Ken Griffey's a contributor in the book as well. Just talk to me about the process of sitting down, writing the book with him. Was there anything that you learned new? I mean, you covered the guy for, you know, a few years, like you stated. So I'm sure you learned even more things about him that you didn't even know just from your career as a beat writer covering the Mariners.
Yeah. I approached him in spring training of 2018. He was still the hitting coach at the time. And I kind of pulled him aside in one of the backfields in Peoria where the Mariners train and said, you know, you're going into your final year. It looks like you're going to get in this year, your final year on the Hall of Fame ballot. I think it'd be a great time to tell your story and do a book, and I'd love to help you with it. And he kind of thought it over, you know, standing there with a bat in his hand, and he thought it over and said, okay. And that was it. So we ironed out the details and the logistics, but it was a little difficult because he was traveling with the team as the hitting coach, and I wasn't traveling with the team. So we had to do our interviews when the team was home. But whenever the team was home throughout that season, I went over to his house a couple times, a homestand, and just sat on a big easy chair in his living room and just talked to him about his life. Hours and hours, tapes that I would transcribe. I pretty much went chronologically, and, you know, I would double back with stuff. But and then I talked to, as I mentioned, I kind of fleshed it out with interviews with teammates, family members, managers. I talked to every one of his minor league managers. Lou, of course, Buehner and Griffey and Wilson and other people who were influential in his life to kind of get a, and I kind of sprinkle those vignettes in the book. It's a little bit of a different technique. It's written in his voice, but there's it's sprinkled with vignettes from, you know, Rick Griffin, the Mariners trainer, or Carmelo Martinez, his cousin. I think it just gives us sort of a 360 degree view of his life. And a couple things I learned. The one thing that really stood out was his passion over the mental side of baseball. There's a whole chapter on that. Edgar honestly believes that that was the difference maker for him, was his mind. And he tells the anecdote about how he, in 1990, he finally won the third base job after years of getting passed over. And he barely had, in his first month, he made four errors in a game, tying a major league record for a third baseman, the most errors. And it really impacted his confidence. And for the first time, he didn't want the ball hit to him, and kind of spilled over to his, batting, and he lost his confidence, which he had always had. So he went to the self-help section of a bookstore and found a book on training your mind. He can't even remember the name of it, but this book he believes this book changed his career, because from that point on he was totally into visualization and affirmation and the subconscious and how to train, you know, the subconscious and eliminate negative thoughts. And he actually trained his mind, you know, he did like these mind exercises for like a half an hour to an hour every day. And he believes that's the only thing, the difference between a batting champion and a run of the mill player is what you do with your mind. And the other thing was his eye condition. Everybody knew he had trouble with his eyes, but I think I went into more depth than it has ever been found out about this strabismus. It's kind of a cross-eyed situation where he couldn't align his eyes, and you can imagine with a 98 mile an hour fastball coming in, if you couldn't align. And I talked extensively with the optometrist who worked with him, Douglas Nicotani, and the exercises he had to do every day of his career to overcome this. And I think that's kind of eye opening to, no pun intended, to a lot of people.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I have a copy waiting for me. One of my friends who's a huge Mariners fan has the book and really was the one that prompted me to try to get you on the show and interview you because he knew I was a big Edgar fan. And so, yeah, it's amazing. I can't wait to read it. It sounds like it's an awesome book and you learn so much about Edgar and you know, his career. And it sounds like it's an awesome read. I can't wait to get to it. I really can't.
Well, I hope you enjoy it. Yesterday I went to Costco, and you know, the weekly Costco run, and I was very pleasantly surprised to see that Edgar was in the book bin there at the Costco, which I didn't even realize. So that's
I can imagine that's very humbling. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very humbling, and it's good for an author to see your book at Costco with all the thousands of people who walk through there.
Right.
It was pretty good. So you can get it at Costco and Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Elliott Bay and all the bookstores and book outlets.
And one last thing before I let you go, Larry, and it's been an awesome conversation. Somebody maybe listening to this that wants to start a career in broadcast journalism or become a sports writer. And you've given a lot of nuggets about your career and the things that you've learned, but if somebody was to ask you, hey, Larry, what's the best piece of advice that you can give a young up and coming journalist or somebody that's thinking about getting in the business? What's the best piece of advice that you can give them?
I think the thing I tell people who want to specifically get into writing, the sports writing aspect of it, is just read everything you can and, you know, find the people that you really like and study their work and what gives him or her the voice that makes it stand out to you. And, you know, even try copying that. You'll find your own voice eventually, but there's nothing wrong. Like when I was young, Jim Murray of the LA Times was the guy that spoke to me, you know, a legendary columnist. And, you know, I just read his stuff voraciously. And I think that helped me sort of shape in my mind what a good story was. And, you know, I don't have experience on the broadcast side of it, but I imagine it's the same thing where, you know, watch the people that you like and what it is about them that makes them good, and use that as the, you know, the starting point for launching your own career. And try and take every opportunity, write for your school paper or work for your school radio station, or freelance for a website, or try and get an internship somewhere, or, you know, just get your name out there. You know, that really does help. You know, people, there's been people that have sent me stories and they're good and I help them, you know, I'm happy to help them. Well, most people are happy to help you. So try and build relationships with people who are in the business, and that will pay you dividends down the road for sure.
Larry Stone, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being my guest this week on the podcast. It was a wonderful discussion. Loved having you on. Before you go ahead and plug your social media, plug Twitter where you can find your column. Go ahead and plug the book again. All the free promotion you can give it. Go ahead.
All right. Well, Stone Larry is my Twitter handle. You can read me at theseattletimes.com. I write it. 3 or 4 time a week column in the Seattle Times. And the book is called Edgar, an Autobiography by Triumph. And it's, I think I'm getting great feedback on the book. The foreword is by Ken Griffey Jr. And, I mean, Edgar just went into the Hall of Fame last week. So it's a great opportunity to find out what led to this Hall of Fame career. And he really did have a fascinating life, which, you know, I didn't get into his upbringing and how he hid on the roof of his family home because he wanted to stay with his grandparents when his parents, who had divorced or had separated, they got back together and they wanted Edgar to move in with them in New York. And he hid on the roof so that he didn't have to go. And he ended up staying with his grandparents in this, you know, this small village in Puerto Rico, Dorado, or the Maguayo neighborhood. And just so many, there's so many points along the way that Edgar
career could have been short-circuited, but he persevered and stuck with it. And I think the book is a good flavor of that and, you know, what made him such a great player.
Awesome. 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 Thank you so much for joining me this week on the podcast again. And we'll definitely have to do this again. It was a great discussion. And I have so many more questions to ask you about Seattle sports, the Mariners, everything. Just pick your mind some more. So we'll definitely have you on, or we'll definitely invite you on the show again.
All right, Manny. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Larry Stone for being my guest this week on the podcast. And really enjoyed the conversation. He's a guy that brings over 40 years of experience. And you could tell he's seen a lot. He really, really conveyed that in the interview today. And I'm just really happy that we were able to set this up. But he had a busy schedule and he took time out of his schedule to give us an hour. So I really, really appreciate it. And I hope you guys enjoy this conversation I have with him. Really, really awesome. But yeah, make sure you follow him on Twitter @StoneLarry. And then also make sure you go to SeattleTimes.com and make sure you follow his column, man. He's a really, really interesting guy. I just recently became a fan of his, work. Started following him because a friend of mine recommended him to me. He's a huge Mariner fan who, reads all of his articles, reads all of his columns, you know, each week, and suggested to me that I should probably have Larry on to talk about Edgar. So yeah, it was awesome. I'm glad we did. We learned so much, and it was still so much. And I felt like I could talk to him for another hour or two just on. I didn't even get a chance to talk to him about so many other things that I wanted to talk to him about. So we'll definitely have to get Larry back on the show. But yeah, make sure you follow him on Twitter @StoneLarry. As always, make sure you follow us on Twitter @AGSPod, on Instagram @AGSPodcast, on Facebook Any Given Sunday. Make sure you become a member of AGS Nation. Make sure you follow me on Twitter @TheEmmanuelBrown and on Instagram @TheEmmanuelBrown, and of course Snapchat @MannyBro15. As always, thank you guys for listening and subscribing to the podcast. Without you guys, there is no podcast. So thank you for supporting the show. And you know, please keep supporting the show. I truly appreciate all the listeners and all the feedback and all the wonderful support that we get each and every week. It's truly mind-blowing. It really is. And make sure you check out all the other podcasts on the Dead End Sports and, you know, Dead End Sports as the Mike Stallone and et cetera, et cetera. Make sure you check out all the other podcasts on the Dead End Podcast Network as well. I'm going to get up out of here. I'm rambling now, but I'm going to get up out of here and enjoy this nice, beautiful weather that we have going on outside. It's close to 80 degrees. It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm going to go spend some time with the family and enjoy the day, man. So I hope you guys have a happy, safe, blessed rest of your week. And check us out next week with another episode of the podcast. Peace.